Hello and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, the show about rationalism, humanism, science and the left. I'm Neil Denny and tonight we are celebrating the life and work of the astronomer, astrobiologist and popularizer of science Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan was the David Duncan Professor of Astronomy and Space Sciences and Director of the Laboratory for Planetary Studies at Cornell University. He was a consultant and advisor to NASA since the 1950s, briefed the Apollo astronauts before their flights to the moon, and was an experimenter on the Mariner, Viking, Voyager and Galileo expeditions to the planets. For his work, Carl Sagan received the NASA medals for exceptional scientific achievement and for distinguished public service, as well as the NASA Apollo Achievement Award. Asteroid 2709 Sagan is named after him. As a scientist trained in both astronomy and biology, Carl Sagan has made seminal contributions to the study of planetary atmospheres, planetary surfaces, the history of the Earth, and exobiology. Carl Sagan became world famous for his TV series Cosmos, A Personal Journey. He has written numerous popular science books, including Brocker's Brain, The Dragons of Eden, Cosmos, Comet, Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, Pale Blue Dot, and The Demon-Haunted World. His novel, Contact, was made into a Hollywood film. Carl Sagan died 10 years ago this week, on the 20th of December, 1996. Tonight we remember him in a number of short interviews with Carl's family, friends, admirers, and former colleagues. Our first interview is with the planetary scientist Carolyn Porco. Okay, I'm talking to Carolyn Porco. Carolyn is currently Senior Research Assistant at the Space Science Institute in Boulder, Colorado, an Adjunct Professor in the Department of Planetary Sciences at the University of Arizona, and an Adjunct Professor at the University of Colorado. She was part of the imaging team on the Voyager missions to the outer planets, and she led the Cassini imaging team. Carolyn, thank you very much for talking to Little Atoms.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, I'm making this program to record the 10th anniversary of the death of Carl Sagan, and I know that you've written that Carl Sagan was quite an influence on you in your early academic career. Could you perhaps tell me about that?
Well, I first ran into Carl. I first saw Carl in person when he came to the university, State University of New York at Stony Brook, which is where I was an undergraduate, and gave a talk. This was, I think, 1972, and he came to talk about the results of Mariner 9, which was the first orbiter of Mars. Mm-hmm. And he was quite impressive even then. I mean, he made a just a wonderful impression as being a very unusual and foresightful person. And then I ran into him when I became a planetary scientist myself. As a graduate student, I would go to meetings like, you know, young scientists do, mm-hmm. and he would be there. And he made a point of getting to know the young people in the field, and he was especially encouraging to people that he felt were in the minorities. And, of course, you know, being a female at that time, I was in the tremendous minority.
Of course.
There were hardly any females at all. So, you know, I am sure, I don't remember the very first one-on-one meeting I had or discussion I had with him. I'm sure, though, he came up to me because that's just the way he was. And I know the very first talk I ever gave, professional talk that I ever gave, which was a terrible talk. It was in 1977. And again, very few women in the audience. And at the end of it, he came up to me, referred to me by my name. So he'd gone through the trouble of remembering my name. And he said, "Carolyn, that was a very nice talk you gave." And, you know, Carl Sagan didn't have to do that to a young, you know, graduate student. He'd already was famous at that time. He'd already had appeared on Johnny Carson. And I just was tremendously impressed with how gracious he was. He was just always so gracious. And then later on, when I became a member of the Voyager Imaging Team, he was already a Voyager Imaging Team member. And so, you know, he became a colleague then. And it just went from there. You know, this was in the 1990s, as his book Contact was going to be made into a movie. He invited me to consult on the movie and kind of give a professional woman's assessment of what the character in the movie should be like. So anyway, and then I became very good friends with him and his wife. So I consider myself to have been very lucky to have known the man. He was a truly unusual person, very old world. You
mentioned your consulting work on Contact, and I was quite interested to read that Carl Sagan had actually suggested to Jodie Foster that she perhaps use yourself as a model for Ellie Arroway, the character that she was playing in the film.
I don't know that he actually spoke to her about it, but that was really part of the plan. And as it turned out, that never happened. I think Jodie Foster, in the end, used Carl as her role model in making the film. And she did, I think, a brilliant job of playing the part.
Okay. Well, you mentioned that you were part of the you were a member of the Voyager imaging teams. But of course, you're sort of, I suppose, most well known from that time for the discovery that you self made. What is described as the spokes on the Saturn ring.
Well, it is interesting how these things go. First of all, I was not the one to discover them. They were just so readily discovered by anybody looking at the pictures. Mm, nobody
okay.
discovered the spokes. They were just so obvious.
Yeah.
But I was the first person to work on them in earnest and prove that, or show, that they had their comings and goings on the ring plane had a specific relationship to the magnetic field. We still, to this day, don't have a very good idea what's making these features. They're still deeply mysterious, and that's one of the things we hope to do with Cassini is understand just exactly how these things come about and what they might tell us about the interactions between the rings and the magnetic field, the magnetosphere, the atmosphere, and so on.
Well, I'm always, when I mentioned that's the thing you're most well known for, as I've just mentioned to you, you first became known to me from you took part in a documentary for the BBC a number of years ago, and you make a comment in that documentary about being, how great it is to feel that you're the only person in the world that knows about that particular thing.
Yeah, it is. It's just that wonderful thrill, you know, that's kind of one of the big benefits of being a scientist. You know, you kind of feel like you're, a shaman or a high priest or something, trying to figure out the mysteries of Mother Nature. And then, you know, in that particular case, again, you know, I was in a very lucky position. I had access to the Voyager images, and everybody was so busy that I had this wonderful topic just fall in my lap. And I got to work on it, and I had made this discovery that there was a connection between the spokes and the magnetic field. And at the time I did that, I mean, literally, at the time I first look at my results and I see this, I literally was the only person on the planet who knew anything about this, and that is such a heady feeling. I mean, it's one thing to have a secret, you know.
Yeah.
You know something the person next door doesn't know. But when you know something about Mother Nature, you know, something as fundamental and as significant as a process that Mother Nature has produced, and no other human in the past or in the present on the face of the planet knows this, you feel almighty. it's a wonderful, wonderful feeling.
Well, there's I've spoken to other contributors about Carl Sagan's gift of being able to be a scientist, a skeptic, an inquirer, but also to bring this gift of being able to put across the wonder, basically the wonder of the universe, and the almost, if I can describe it as such a way, there's almost the religious feeling of how wonderful the universe is. And that's it, that what you've just described there is one of those moments, isn't it?
It is one of those moments. I wouldn't call it so much religious as I would call it spiritual.
Sure, okay.
I think it has a completely different connotation, and there is something very, very spiritual about being a scientist, and in particular being an astronomer and being a planetary explorer, because we do, vicariously, but nonetheless, we do in a sense go to other places. We experience the mysterious, in a way that other scientists, other people don't. And it is a means to feel a very deep connection to the cosmos. I mean, we are already connected to the cosmos. This was Carl's message, you know, that we are the cosmos coming to understand itself. And that is so true. And I think everybody can have this kind of appreciation of this. And all they need to do is engage. They need to engage themselves. I don't mean that they need to become scientists. I think they just need to learn, to be open to what it is that we are finding about the cosmos, about our connection to the cosmos. And they, too, can come to just be caught up in the wonder of it all and be uplifted by it. It's not something that makes you feel small and insignificant, as I've heard it described. You know, you stand up, you look at the stars, you realize how utterly, tremendously small we are compared to the grandeur and the magnificence and the breadth and size of the universe. But that doesn't make me feel insignificant. If anything, the fact that we can know, that we have the means, we've come to the point where we have the means to know our cosmic context is ultimately empowering and uplifting and intoxicating. And so this is what does it for me. I don't need to be religious. I don't need to believe in a God. I don't need to believe in an afterlife. This is what does it for me. And I think that this is what Carl really was trying to say. He was trying to get people to embrace the cosmos, embrace their circumstances, and appreciate it for what it means and how beautiful in its truth, how beautiful it really is.
Okay, so we were talking about Voyager and the Voyager mission. The Voyager missions were in the late 70s, but we've recently been back to Saturn, particularly with the Cassini mission, and you were the leader of the imaging team on this. So what was it like to return to Saturn?
Well, for me, returning to Saturn was like going home, because I did my professional dissertation on discoveries in the rings of Saturn by Voyager, and so I feel like I cut my teeth on studying that planet. And I just, you know, when you're young, how impressed you can be with, you know, some an experience that is so new and so profound and so thrilling. And so for me, going back to Saturn was like going back to the land of my youth. It really was a very sentimental journey for me, especially when we first saw Jupiter. You know, this was October, the year 2000, and we were approaching Jupiter, and Jupiter was like the gateway to the outer solar system, so I knew it was only going to be a matter of a few more years before we reached Saturn. And it was just a very emotional moment to see those images of Jupiter. And then, of course, when we finally did get to see Saturn, it was coming home. It's been just a tremendous privilege to be a part of this major exploratory expedition that we are presently conducting around Saturn.
This expedition has obviously been a lot more intensive on Saturn and particularly its satellites. So tell me about you're the director of Cyclops. What's Cyclops?
Cyclops is the outfit here, my group. It's an acronym, that name, and it stands for the Cassini Imaging Central Laboratory of Operations. And it is here where we built the software that allows us to command the cameras. We've built the software that allows us to calibrate the cameras. We conduct the sequencing of the images. Some of that goes on other places on my team, but for the most part it happens here. And it is here also that we process the images for release to the public. So we are, as it says, the center of operations of the Cassini imaging team.
And Cyclops has a great weblog that you sort of maintain as well. Do you know the web address?
You mean our website?
Yeah.
Oh, it's easy. It's Cyclops, deliberately misspelled as CICLOPS.org, and that is where we post the the images that we release to the public and other important information.
That's great. Okay, well, Carolyn, thank you very much for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Okay, very good.
Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.
You are listening to Little Atoms, and tonight we are celebrating the life and work of Carl Sagan. Our next contributor is A.C. Grayling.
Okay, I'm talking to Professor A.C. Grayling. Anthony Grayling is the Professor of Philosophy at Birkbeck College. Anthony is a believer in the idea that the philosopher should actively engage in public debate, and has written numerous popular philosophy books, many newspaper columns, and made many appearances on television and radio, including Little Atoms, in pursuit of that aim. Anthony, thank you for speaking to us again.
Great pleasure.
You're a popularizer of philosophy. Now, Carl Sagan, an extremely accomplished astronomer and scientist, is probably best known in this country as a charismatic popularizer of science on television in the sort of James Burke or Magnus Pike role. Now, and I mentioned those names who are way back from the 70s or early 80s, as there's not really anybody of that sort of ilk around these days, is there? I think David Attenborough is probably the closest.
Yes, although I think there are people, you know, like John Gribben and Paul Davies and others who write books for the general public on developments in science. And they're following in Sagan's tradition there, I think, and doing a very, very good job, because Sagan always said how terribly important it is that scientific literacy in the general public should be increased. You know, it was a very important point for him that great decisions are going to be made about the climate, about nuclear weapons and so nuclear power technology and so on. How could those decisions be taken by very few people with the general public being ignorant? And so I think that they're really treading a bit in his footsteps there and trying to get us informed, which is quite right.
You're absolutely right. Popular science books sell hugely in this country, but there isn't somebody commanding a television audience in the multi-millions as used to happen. I mean, I know television's diversified. There's a lot more channels. But do you think the sort of public appetite for that sort of television programme has dissipated?
Well, it has, hasn't it? Because I suppose the large number of channels now, as you say, has diffused the audience, so that, you know, back in the great days of Brunofsky and Kenneth Clark,
sure,
and Carl Sagan, when they could really command these absolutely vast audiences as Sagan did. I mean, he had the biggest viewing public, I think, for many years. And alas, that's gone. And part of the problem, I suppose, is that there just aren't, and this is an implication of what you said earlier, there just aren't these very charismatic people, great communicators, full of enthusiasm and lucidity and eloquence, as Sagan was, who could really grip people and make them want to turn the television on week after week to see what he had to say.
So do you think, let's talk about that, do you think there's something particular about Carl Sagan that made him appealing in that way?
Yes, he had an extraordinary gift in that respect. There were people who said that he wasn't a serious scientist because he'd spent all his time popularizing and writing a novel and that kind of thing.
Sure.
And that's just nonsense. I mean, he did do very good scientific work. He was a planetary scientist.
Absolutely.
And made a big contribution in that respect too. But the point was that he understood his science well, and that's a key to being able to express it to a wider audience in a clear way. And he had this knack, this gift for communicating what are, after all, fairly complicated ideas, but very exciting ones, with all the enthusiasm and eloquence that the subject commanded. I remember reading in his Demon-Haunted World an anecdote that he tells there about talking to a taxi driver. You may remember that.
Sure.
And this man going on and on about Atlantis and all sorts of other things. And he said he was a man really interested in these subjects.
He had the appetite,
but he was ignorant. He didn't know that there was even more exciting real science out there. And that's the key to Sagan, because he really wanted to be able to express to people this, you know, the wonder that the world is, uh-huh, the scientific inquiry into it is.
That's that's something I was going to bring up, because that's what he seems to do for me, is he has this gift of unifying his scepticism and rationalism with a definite wonder in scientific achievements. And you know, he goes on about the primacy of the scientific method and experiment and inquiry, but still has this almost religious awe at the majesty of the universe as well.
Well, that's right. You see, he somehow preserves that that childlike wonder, which right back in classical antiquity, people like Socrates and others said is the beginning of philosophy. The reason why people begin thinking about things is because they're astonished by the, you know, stupendous majesty and beauty of the world, and they really want to try and understand it. And if you think that the word philosophy just means inquiry, then Carl Sagan is very much a philosopher, an inquirer,
absolutely,
wanting to understand, wanting to convey something of that sense of extraordinary awe.
We've mentioned, obviously, the book The Demon Haunted World, subtitled Science is a Candle in the Dark, and this for me is you know, I think it's absolutely a must-read book.
Well, you're dead right. I mean, it's a book that should be put into the hand of every secondary school child to read, you know, because, of course, there's a kind of caricature of the sceptical attitude. It sounds cold and logical and dismissive. And Sagan and the scientific tradition don't at all mean that by scepticism. They mean a healthy, inquiring, interested scepticism that really sifts the evidence and tries to make really good sense of it. Intellectual honesty is the driving force behind it. You know, being open-minded, not so open-minded that your brains fall out, that's part of the problem there, but, you know, really wanting to listen to really good arguments, a really good case for something, looking at the evidence, testing the hypotheses vigorously, and by that means moving on our understanding about the world. And that's what The Demon Haunted World is about. It's a kind of recipe book. It's brilliant. It's wonderfully lucid and clear, and it sets out exactly how one should go about doing this in this very responsible way.
Well, you mentioned that, and Carl Sagan sets out his baloney detection kit, which
That's right.
His tools for sceptical thinking. Perhaps more specifically, as you're a philosopher, he also lists a number of the sort of fallacies of logic and rhetoric that he...
Yes, absolutely. Well, first on the baloney detection kit, you know, he says there, you know, always get independent confirmation of your facts. Always seek out people who are you know, expert and interested in the field and listen to their different points of view about this. But at the same time, don't think that just because somebody is a putative authority that therefore they carry extra weight. Always advance a variety of hypotheses and subject them to rigorous tests wherever you can. Make sure that every step in an argument is secure. If there are competing hypotheses, choose the one that's simplest. This is an application of Occam's razor, as it's called. And always ask yourself, what would falsify this hypothesis? What would show that it's wrong? Here he's echoing Karl Popper, who said, an hypothesis or a theory that explains absolutely everything and can never be refuted explains nothing, it's empty. And then he also was very careful to go through all the different kinds of fallacies that people use. For example, instead of attacking your opponent's argument, you attack the person himself. This is the argumentum ad hominem. Appealing to authority, as you just said. Begging the question by sneaking the conclusion that you want into the argument that you put. Not understanding statistics. I think it was he who invented the joke, didn't he, that President Eisenhower was very dismayed to learn that half of all Americans were below average intelligence. You know, I mean, it was, you know, that kind of misunderstanding of the way figures work. Thinking that because B follows A must have caused B. Thinking in terms of slippery slopes, you know, give somebody an inch and take a mile, that idea that if you eat one banana, you're going to eat a million, you know, that's a fallacy. Setting up a straw man as your opponent, I mean, weak arguments or the weakest arguments of the opposing position to refute it instead of the strongest ones. All these and others are fallacies of reasoning and thought, and he lists them there, and going through them and learning them is a tremendous fortifying experience.
So we're talking on basically the 10th anniversary of Carl Sagan's death, and I wonder if we could perhaps think of some sort of legacy for him beyond handing out a copy of The Demon Haunted World to every secondary school. How do we go about putting these ideas forward?
Well, you know, I mean, certainly I think that his humanism, his rationalism, his scepticism, his championing of the scientific outlook, because famously he said, you know, science is not just a body of accumulating knowledge, it's also an attitude to the world. And that attitude is the one that he describes so beautifully in The Demon Haunted World. And so I think that is a great legacy. Of course, there are other people who've urged that as well, but he's a real champion of that cause, and is worth remembering for that. And the other great thing, which I'm sure you've talked about with the other guests too, is this marvelous enterprise, the SETI, you know, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And I think that is one of the great legacies there, because, you know, until he got together a group of people who signed a letter saying that this was a serious project that scientists should be looking to, it was regarded as science fiction stuff and pie in the sky. People were afraid to say that they wanted to take it seriously. But he made everybody take it seriously. And now, all over the world, sleeping computers are busy, you know, working away together in unison, looking for possible bits of information from outer space. And one of these days, if the statistics are right, we're going to find it. And it's going to be partly, at any rate, due to Carl Sagan. And it's a wonderful legacy.
It took a while for it to be disassociated from this conspiracy mindset of the sort of UFO abductees.
Well, absolutely. I mean, in fact, one of the things that Sagan discusses in Demon Haunted World is this belief in UFOs. And he was very interesting on it because he said, you know, underlying this is a sort of quasi-religious urge, wanting there to be people out there, maybe, you know, beings who might come and save us or have superior knowledge or something. Of course, there's the other anxiety that they might not like us, you know, and be stronger than us and so on. But he managed to distinguish all that, or all the pie-in-the-sky stuff, from something rather serious, because the numbers just, you know, add up, given the extent of the universe, given the probability that there are many worlds like our own out there in planetary systems. The chances of there being life and some proportion of that life being intelligent life are, you know, not insignificant. And since that's the case, it makes sense to include in our examination of the universe a search for signs.
Anthony, thanks very much for speaking to Little Atoms again.
A great pleasure.
This is Little Atoms, commemorating the 10th anniversary of the death of Carl Sagan. Next up is an interview with the Executive Director of the Planetary Society, Louis Friedman.
Okay, I'm talking to Louis Friedman, who is the Executive Director of the Planetary Society, which is the world's largest space interest group. Louis co-founded the society along with Carl Sagan and Bruce Murray. Previous to this, Louis had worked for at least 10 years at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and was involved in the design and planning of numerous of the deep space missions. Louis, thank you very much for agreeing to talk to Little Atoms.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Tell me about why the Planetary Society was set up. I understand this was at a sort of time when you'd noticed that NASA and the US government was pulling back from the idea of space exploration.
Yeah, it was really the end of the 1970s, and Carl Sagan was out here in California working on two giant projects. One was Voyager, which was just beginning its exploration of the outer solar system. It had encountered Jupiter. It was on its way to Saturn. And the other was the Cosmos TV show, which mm-hmm. became the enormous success that it had on television worldwide. And he was struck by the enormous popularity of planetary exploration, as evidenced by all the things he was working on. And together with Bruce Murray, who was then the director of JPL, they kept saying, you know, planetary exploration has all this excitement in the public, and the political people are out to kill it. And in fact, NASA is even on the verge of making a decision to put planetary exploration aside for a decade while they build the shuttle. So they began speaking to me, who I was working at the time in a congressional fellowship in the U.S. Congress, about this situation, and we said that our goal was to form a grassroots organization, a popular organization that could convince the decision makers that not only was this good stuff, but it was very popular. It was stuff the public was really wanted, and that's why we decided to form a popular-based membership organization, and we quickly got a number of allies together and grew very rapidly to become the world's largest space interest group.
So you call it a space interest group. I wonder if in the UK we call a pressure group, which is a sort of a group that lobbies the government about its certain particular interest. I wonder if this is a similar sort of thing. So what sort of things are the Planetary Society doing now?
Well, we don't mind being known as a lobby from time to time, as a pressure group from time to time, but we do much more than that. And I think our charter is actually to inspire the people of Earth to explore new worlds and seek other life. And in that regard, we're more about the inspiration, the public information, the grand discoveries we make on other worlds, the adventure of space exploration missions, and the pressure and lobbying activities come into play when the government or governments, since we are an international organization, make decisions that basically are based on their misperception of political interest in these subjects. When they decide it can be quietly put aside, as is actually going on in the U.S. right now, where they're decreasing the science program in NASA, even though these missions have been so extraordinarily popular. They're decreasing the science missions. We then become a pressure group or a lobby. But we do, as I say, much more. We also fund scientific research. We've been private funders of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence for more than two decades. We've funded near-Earth object observations. And in the last few years, we've tried a really bold venture to conduct our own space mission, the world's first solar sail flight.
So tell me about the solar sail. It's very exciting.
Well, this is basically the Planetary Society tries to seed and create projects that are exciting to the public and also help will seed further exploration. And solar sailing is especially exciting because it's the only technology we know that could lead to interstellar flight in the far future. And the space agencies, while they keep talking about it, really don't have plans to even test it out. And we got the opportunity to do a privately funded solar sail development with Russian partners, and we carried it off all the way to building the spacecraft and the sail module, delivering it to the launch vehicle, but then the launch failed, and unfortunately, and that's something we had no control over. Mm-hmm. So we're going to try again. We have, I think, the ability to do this again. We're not very happy about the launch vehicle situation, so we'll change our launch vehicle. But this is probably the boldest venture of the Planetary Society. We've been involved with space missions. We do send things on planetary mission probes, and we even send hardware to the surface of Mars on the Mars Exploration Rover. But to actually conduct our own mission certainly is our boldest venture.
So let's talk about some of the science behind it. How does the sail actually work?
Well, the principle is to use the photons of sunlight, the pure energy of sunlight, or any light, actually, in interstellar travel it would be laser light, use photon pressure. Light bounces off a highly reflective surface and transfers momentum to that object, and in the case of the spacecraft, it would be transferred to it and either increase its speed if you point the velocity vector, if you point the resultant force along the velocity vector, or if you point it against it, then you would decrease your speed. And either way, you could go outward from the solar system or inward in the solar system. So you build up a velocity change by continuously acting sunlight pressure reflecting off a very highly reflective surface, which in our case is a luminized mylar, but it could be any kind of highly reflection, thin, very thin object, because you want to have as low a mass as possible so that you transfer all your momentum into velocity.
So basically the craft would accelerate and accelerate because obviously there's no sort of
sunlight pressure, right. Mm-hmm. Pressure is a force, and the sunlight pressure would create a force which creates an acceleration.
How far can this actually work? I mean, what happens to the point where you get what happens when you get further and further away from the sun?
Well, you run out of sun, practical use of the sun, really quite, you know, well within the solar system, maybe out of distances like Jupiter. And then to do interstellar travel, you first of all have to be, at that point, be going at very high speeds, which you would have built up in the inner solar system. And then secondly, at that point, you would want to use a highly focused laser. Sunlight is basically spread out over all the spectrum and over all an omnidirection. But a laser can be focused along a pencil beam of light, and so that can be focused over long interstellar distances. But I'm talking powerful lasers. I'm talking lasers that would be built in space that would harness sunlight energy to power them and would be an enormous size. So basically you're talking about something that's more than a century away.
And are the lasers attached to the craft?
No, the lasers would sit out here in the solar system someplace and be pointed over interstellar distances. So that's the real advantage to light sailing. You never have to carry your fuel or any propulsion device along. And so then you just push the laser light out to these long distances over interstellar, building up a fair amount of interstellar distance, and you'll be going at such high speeds that you'll be able to make it all the way to another star system. And I should emphasize that in that application, we are talking centuries, but like the Wright brothers did in 1903, we want to fly the first the first control solar sail flight to sort of prove the technology, knowing that it'll be decades as it takes us out through the solar system and much further.
Sure, but you could actually prove in principle that it's sort of feasible,
right,
having a sort of prototype. And I've read that this the prototype that the launch that fell, but obviously the new one as well, is big enough to be visible with the naked eye as well.
Yes, yeah. So this is something I think that Carl Sagan would not have imagined us doing so quickly, perhaps, or so, you know, in our own space mission. But he certainly would. He wrote about solar sailing even back in the late 1970s or early 1980s, I believe, in a Parade magazine article. He was certainly supportive and enamored of the technology. That's one thing about Carl. He was always enamored of the great adventure of space exploration, as well as the scientific part of its discoveries and what we'd learned out there.
Well, Louis, thank you very much for going to speak to us.
Well, I appreciate it very much. We're remembering Carl Sagan, of course, on our website today at planetary.org, and I certainly encourage people to follow some of our exploits.
And people can obviously to join up to the Planetary Society on the website as well.
That's right. Just come to us at www.planetary.org.
That's great. Thank you very much, Louis.
Well, thank you.
I'm Neil Denny, and this is Little Atoms, and our next interview is with the planetary biologist, Stephen Soter.
Okay, I'm talking to Stephen Soter. Stephen is currently scientist in residence at the Center for Ancient Studies at New York University, and a research associate of the Department of Astrophysics and American Museum of Natural History in New York. Stephen was a longtime friend and colleague of Carl Sagan, collaborating with him and with Andrew Yan on the TV series Cosmos and its associated book. Stephen, thank you for talking to Little Atoms.
You're welcome.
Carl Sagan and yourself were quite instrumental in the fields of astrobiology and exobiology becoming credible areas of scientific study. Can you tell me a little about this, when you first began with this, and what it was like, what the sort of atmosphere was like to be studying?
Well, I began to be interested in it in the early 1960s. In the prospect of life outside the Earth.
Uh-huh.
And so I was studying astronomy at that time, and my faculty advisor told me that it was ridiculous to be concerned about life outside the Earth. It sounded like science fiction to most people. But I saw Carl Sagan on a television interview at that time, and he was talking sensibly and scientifically about this subject, and that encouraged me. When I was a graduate student at Cornell in 1968, he actually then came to that university, and I was delighted at that, and we became fast friends. Eventually collaborated on the television series Cosmos.
So how did that collaboration actually come about?
Well, I originally was just going to be doing the research for the series, but I then began suggesting some ideas for program content, and so became a co-writer along with Andrianne, who then also became Carl's wife. The three of us wrote the series together.
So were you surprised at how successful the series was?
Yes, actually. apparently became the most widely watched television documentary up to its time.
There's an idea that being the sort of public figure that Carl Sagan was, in some way affected his standing as a scientist and an astronomer. And I wondered if you saw any of this yourself.
Yes, I did. There's no question that he was a first-class scientist, but some of his colleagues thought that it was unseemly for a scientist to be going to the public, to be appearing, for example, on the Johnny Carson show, to be writing for Parade magazine and spreading the word about science. And they took it out on him in various ways. He was denied membership in the National Academy of Sciences, probably because of that. And that affected him very deeply. But he persisted because he thought it was very important to keep the public informed about what they were paying for, about the scientific enterprise.
Well, let's perhaps, Stephen, we could talk a bit about your current work now. And just one of the subjects I want to discuss is the exoplanets, first of all. It's the case now, isn't it, that we have a certain type of observational evidence of planets around other stars?
Yes, there's now been discovered something like 200 planets around other stars. We cannot see them directly. We can see indirectly their effects on the stars that they orbit, and they've been detected that way. So far, the method only allows us to see the more massive planets and the ones that are closest to their stars, but it seems to be that they are very common. And there's other evidence that almost all normal stars have planetary systems.
There's you mentioned that we can see this presumably the sort of the gas giants, the Jupiter-sized planets,
yes,
that are nearer to the stars. Now the situation in our solar system is obviously that the small terrestrial planets are nearer to this,
yes,
nearer to this to the sun, and the bigger planets are further out. And presumably at one point this was thought was going to be common.
Well, it may still be common. The problem is we're suffering under a selection effect. We can only see, the methods only allow us to see the more massive planets that are close in. And so those systems that might resemble ours, we cannot yet detect. Now, with missions that are now in the planning, we may eventually be able to detect them, and they may be there. On the other hand, it could turn out that our system is a very unusual type. We don't yet know.
So how, give me a quick description of how we are detecting these massive planets.
Well, the main method is that when a massive planet is in orbit around a star, the star does not remain absolutely fixed in its position in space. It orbits around the common center of mass of the system made up of the star and the planet.
Mm-hmm.
That center of mass is closer to the star, which is more massive than it is to the planet, but it does induce the star to make a small orbit around that position in space.
One of the big controversies that's rumbling around in the astronomy world for a while is this idea about the sort of outer planets, and Pluto particularly, is Pluto a planet? And you've actually been involved in this, haven't you?
Yes, I wrote an article in an astronomical journal in a popular version in Scientific American in January of 2007. Issue, and the story is really that there is now a whole class of objects beyond Neptune, of which Pluto is merely one of the largest ones. They're called Kuiper Belt objects,
mm-hmm,
and they are dynamically very much unlike planets in that they cross each other's orbits and they're relatively small. The other eight planets of the solar system are in non-intersecting orbits. These objects beyond the orbit of Neptune, called Kuiper Belt objects, actually resemble somewhat another class of objects that's been known for 200 years, the asteroids, which are in a belt between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. Both these families, the asteroids and the Kuiper Belt objects, represent the leftover debris from the formation of the planets. The planets are the winners in a kind of competition for building material in the rotating disk of gas and dust that formed the solar system. So the planets got the major share of the matter that was in that disk, but the leftover debris is in the form of asteroids and Kuiper Belt objects, and one of the Kuiper Belt objects is Pluto. It was the first one discovered in 1930. It took a long time until the next one was discovered in 1992, but now we know that there are thousands of them. So it's a different class and has a different kind of dynamical history than the eight larger objects that we consider as planets.
So is this now the official classification?
Well, the International Astronomical Union has adopted a definition that a planet is an object which has cleared its orbital zone.
Mm-hmm.
That's not actually a very precise definition because there's still material that drifts into the orbital neighborhood of planets and gets scattered by them or swept up by them. But basically, they dominate their neighborhoods in the solar system. And the smaller objects, the debris, the Kuiper Belt objects, the comets, the asteroids, do not do that. So there's a distinction between the eight objects that are now regarded as planets and everything else.
Okay, Stephen, that's great. Thank you very much for agreeing to speak to Little Atoms.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to Little Atoms. Our final interview tonight is with Andrew Yarn.
Okay, I'm talking to Andrew Yarn. Anne is an author, a lecturer, and a producer for film and television, a founder and the president of the Carl Sagan Foundation. She was a co-producer and a co-creator of the Warner Brothers film of Contact, written from Carl Sagan's book Contact, which Anne co-authored, and she also co-authored other books by Carl Sagan, for instance, Pale Blue Dot, The Demon-Haunted World, Billions and Billions, and Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors. She was the creative director of the NASA Voyager Interstellar Record. And last but not least, I suppose I should say, she was also married to Carl for nearly 20 years. Anne, thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us.
I'm happy to be talking with you, Neil.
Perhaps we should talk about Carl as a man. I've talked to some other contributors about his work and why he was popular as a promoter of science and as a scientist. But obviously you were married to him. So can you tell me something about Carl himself?
Well, he had one of the most beautiful laughs of any human being I've ever heard, completely uninhibited and just filled with life. He was, I've never known anyone who lived as fully as he did. He was it's interesting that one of the areas of his scientific study was, of course, questions about the origin of life and the possibilities of life elsewhere. But I think it's really impressive is the way he lived. And he was a very conscientious citizen of the planet Earth, very willing to spend weeks, years of his time campaigning for the wise and humane use of science and high technology, as well as willing to demonstrate at the Nevada nuclear test site against the underground nuclear testing that was going on. In fact, the U.S. government exploded a nuclear weapon right underneath him as he was speaking, and we were all gathered for the purpose of the protest. He would go to kindergartens to send little five-year-olds spinning like planets and convey something of the wonder of the universe as revealed by science. He spoke at naturalization ceremonies to welcome new citizens to the country and to implore them to question authority and to memorize and commit to heart the Bill of Rights. He was a wonderful father, amazingly, I was just thinking, in fact, I was writing this blog, which is my debut as a blogger.
Just let me interrupt you there. There's you can describe it, a world blogathon going on.
Yes, there'll be a global blogathon on December 20th, because it is tragically the 10th anniversary of Carl's death. And so I am inaugurating my own blog, but meanwhile participating with some, I think, 30 or more bloggers worldwide. I've had inquiries from China, from Korea, from Spain, from all over the world, of people who remember Carl, who know what December 20th means, and who want to interact with this kind of globe-girdling commemoration of Carl's life. And I find myself writing about him as a father and as a human being, and just really what a tremendously loving, tender, funny, generous, kind, patient person he was. And I think as a human being, intimately, he was as astonishing as he was as a public figure, and that's very unusual in my experience.
Well, I mean, it seems that was clearly part of Carl's appeal as a public intellectual as well, wasn't it?
Exactly. He was so authentic, and he was incapable of being dishonest. In fact, if he was ever in a situation where he had to pretend that he liked something that he didn't in order to spare someone's feelings, his nose would twitch. And we always knew, whether or not, he was what he really felt, because he was so transparent that way. And it was another thing that I just found so completely lovable about him, is that he was surreal.
I spoke to Stephen Soter earlier about this crazy and ridiculous idea that Carl's public advocacy of science somehow affected him in the eyes of his sort of his peers in the sort of science community.
Mm-hmm.
And something that you've just raise something which was his political activity as well. I mean, there was...
That's sort of the tragedy that we see now, is that there are wonderful exponents of science. There are scientists who can really describe their work in a very stirring way and, you know, make it clear and accessible to the rest of us. But I think one of the things that really made Carl so special was that he was immune to the seduction of fame and power, in the sense that, you know, he turned down 3 invitations to the Reagan White House for dinner.
Sure.
Because he just wasn't, he couldn't be co-opted that way. He really, he turned down, you know, millions of dollars in offers for product endorsements that he would absolutely never even consider accepting.
Well, you mentioned Reagan there. I mean, and Carl saw through the whole sort of Star Wars farrago quite simply, didn't he?
Yes, he did, and he spent an enormous amount of time traveling the world, really, trying to, and especially in the United States, trying to convince people of how foolish and ill-conceived it was. And he did the same for his concerns about nuclear winter and global warming. He's, for many people, one of the first to sound the alarm in the scientific community about global warming. And in fact, he did his PhD thesis as a very young man at the University of Chicago on the greenhouse effect on Venus and, you know, extrapolated what that might mean on Earth. And, you know, was indefatigable, really, in trying to communicate these dangers to the widest possible public. And there was nothing, no perk, nothing that could possibly keep him from mounting this campaign and being completely outspoken. And it's another great reason why I treasure with such pride his memory.
I suppose it's ironic that it's you know, now we're coming round to the idea that of global warming, and you know, people are beginning to think that something seriously has to be done, and you know, there was Carl more than 10 years ago coming up with the same ideas.
Yes, exactly. You know, 20 years ago, and even more than that, raising these questions, and I'm just so extremely proud. And I think what's really impressive also is how well his science holds up. The latest discoveries on Mars. I just saw yesterday a science writer, saying that, you know, it was only Carl Sagan who expressed the question of whether or not our spacecraft missions to Mars hadn't asked the right questions in determining whether or not there had been water on Mars and perhaps life. And, you know, once again, I see he's vindicated. In the new book, The Varieties of Scientific Experience, Carl, in 1985, speculating during the course of the Gifford lectures that were given in Glasgow, he speculates about the atmosphere of Titan and a variety of other ideas. And in during the scientific updates with the wonderful Steve Soter, who you mentioned earlier, we were both so impressed with how right on Carl was about the science. And, of course, he was, you know, accused of being so speculative, and yet he was, for the most part, right. And when he was wrong, he saw no shame in admitting that. And that was another – he thought that was a great strength of science. And it's another reason why I admire him so.
So tell me about the Carl Sagan Foundation. What sort of work does it do?
Well, our first project, which I'm tremendously gratified and proud, is the Carl Sagan Discovery Center, which it was the first pediatric hospital to be built in the Bronx, where there are children who, by every demographic, are among the most underserved in the United States. And we raised $1 million to help build the part of the hospital which makes the entire hospital, every gene of the hospital, a celebration of the wonders of nature as revealed by science. And just to give you a very brief example of how cool it is, it's only 11 stories high, but it was built on the highest elevation in the greater New York City area. So it has a spectacular view of the surrounding Palisades of New Jersey, the rivers, all of the great topographical features of the greater New York area. And every room has these beautiful plate glass, huge picture windows of the surrounding environs. And they pulled the shade down. You see that exact same scene, only it's 100 million years ago, or 10 million years ago in some cases, or 500,000 years ago. And the whole idea is that it's telling you that there were dinosaurs in New Jersey, something that, you know, most of us don't imagine, and that you're part of this great sacred continuity of cosmic evolution and locally evolution, and that this is a profound and wondrous truth, something that Carl was always trying to communicate. By the way, this is one of the few hospitals in the country where no one can be turned away for lack of insurance, which I'm very happy to say. We're also working now to raise money for the Carl Sagan Academy, which is the very first public charter school in the history of the United States that is a humanist charter school. The story of the Carl Sagan Academy is just so wonderful. It's a public school, again, in a very underserved community, Hillsborough County, Florida, which is the Tampa, Florida area. And we work together with the American Humanist Association and the Baptist ministers of Hillsborough County. And the American Humanist Association went to these people and said, you know, we don't have the same belief system that you do. We actually don't believe in God. But we love your children, and we would like to give them a world-class education in math and science and critical thinking. And so right now, the Carl Sagan Foundation is attempting to raise money for the Carl Sagan Academy so that we can begin to fulfill the promise that we made to these kids. We were very proud to be the most improved school in the county, but the kids that we're working with have absolutely a minimum of resources, and that's why we feel it'd be very important to help them out here.
Well, let's hope in the face of school authorities trying to bring creationism into schools in other parts of America, that's a big success, obviously.
It is a big success, and I really love this model of people who don't agree with each other and have a completely different worldview being willing to put those disagreements aside in the service of our children. That is, I think, I wish the whole world was like that. And I just feel like that's a very critical, wonderful example of what's possible.
And I mentioned in my introduction that you were the creative director of the NASA Voyager in Golden Record, the interstellar record that's gone out and now is, well, heaven knows where it is, you know, somewhere beyond the planet.
Well, it was, it followed on the success of the Pioneer plaque, which Carl and Linda Salzman and Frank Drake designed for Pioneer. But, of course, this was a chance to do something even more complex on a golden phonograph record. And so we were able to send 118 pictures of life on Earth, greetings in 59 human languages, and one non-human language, the greetings of the humpback whales, and as well as a kind of sound essay of the history of the planet. And most beautifully and really memorably, a very impressive, to me anyway, selection of world music that if the engineers who designed the Voyagers can be relied upon, and certainly the awesome performance of the Voyagers exceeding far beyond anything that their engineers could have even dreamt, says that these engineers know what they're saying. If they are to be believed, the future of the Voyager record is 100 million years. And all of that time moving at some 38,000 miles per hour. But, just an awesome opportunity to create, you know, the ultimate desert island disc of human culture. And I'm so proud and I feel so ridiculously fortunate to have had a role in that.
And this could be found somewhere by some alien civilization long after human life has ceased to exist on the Earth.
Well, I hope it'll still exist.
Let's hope so.
But the fact is that if you were to come, if you were to return to the Earth a billion years from now from space, you would not even recognize the surface of the planet, let alone hope to find the Great Wall of China or the pyramids or any of our proudest achievements. The shape of the continents and their relationship to each other would have changed visibly in that period of time. It's such a long amount of time.
But I also imagine that nobody will have surpassed some of the music that's included on that disc as well.
Well, that's my prejudice, because we're all a product of our own times. But I have to say that, you know, the idea that Louis Armstrong and Chuck Berry and Blind Willie Johnson and Bach and Mozart and Beethoven and, you know, exquisite gamelan music and just a wonderful assortment of brilliant musicians creating what is for us Earthlings, I think, a very memorable collection.
And thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it, Neil, and I hope we'll talk again.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, I'm going to play us out tonight with a piece of music, the third movement from Heaven and Hell by Vangelis, better known as the theme from Cosmos. In the epilogue to Carl Sagan's posthumous book, Billions and Billions, Andrew Yon recalls receiving letters from admirers of Carl, which describe how Carl's example has inspired them to work for science and reason against the forces of superstition and fundamentalism. I'll just say one thing, that without Carl Sagan, there would be no little atoms. Thanks for listening.